now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Would you please mix me a mojito? We're heading to Cuba, friends. Journalist Reese Ehrlich was there in January, and he followed up on the allegations that American diplomats were sidelined by a strange sonic weapon, producing headaches, concussions, and other bodily symptoms. And Reese Ehrlich followed up and found nada. He'll give you the details in a moment. We'll also avail ourselves of his expertise on Syria, the shooting gallery that is really wide open warfare, almost more than in the recent past. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who take out subscriptions for $5 or $10 a month. And I invite you to join people like Jason Ferguson, Janet Price, Joey Perillo, and Tim McKay. They're stalwart supporters, and you can join them. Just visit peterbcollins.com, click on the menu tab, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page, and you can be good to go in just a few minutes. One of Cuba's secret weapons is its music. People are drawn from all over the world to catch the sounds of Cuba. And this is Willie Colon, El Malo, opening the podcast today. Just about a year ago, stories were circulating about sinister use of sound against American diplomats in Cuba. And it's a story that just kind of went away. It disappeared into the ether somewhere. But our friend Reese Ehrlich, the independent, investigative, international reporter, has recently returned from Cuba, and he shares with us an update on the wave of, at least the allegations of sonic weapons being used on Americans in Havana. Reese, always great to talk with you, and I do want to plug your most recent book, Inside Syria. We'll talk about that before we end the podcast here today. But thanks for joining us, and tell us what you found in Cuba.
Well, as you mentioned, there were a series of lurid stories last fall, all leaked from the State Department, that indicated U.S. diplomats in Havana were under some kind of sonic attack. They were suffering from all kinds of maladies, including concussions and hearing loss and extreme stress and all kinds of headaches and so on. And at the time, the President Trump indicated that this was an attack organized by the Cuban government against diplomats. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. pulled about half of its diplomats out of Havana and expelled 15 Cuban diplomats from the Washington embassy because of these alleged attacks.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure the FBI dug into this, and they've come up with the cause and who we can blame for it, right?
Right. They've come up with zippity-doo-dah, as we say in Cuba. The FBI made 4 trips, according to Cuban officials. The Cuban officials cooperated completely, they said, and the FBI came up with nothing. The Cuban government did not attack the diplomats. There was no indication of an attack at all. And one mainstream journalist that I spoke with down there called it bullshit. In short, there was absolutely no proof from the FBI after their investigation that an attack took place.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that they fanned out in the neighboring homes where the people reported impact from this alleged secret weapon. And did they find anybody who had hearing loss, who had any of the same symptoms that afflicted Americans?
None at all. So here was the situation. The U.S. claimed that the diplomats were under this sonic attack in their homes, which of course are away from the embassy, and within hotel rooms where they had stayed in Havana.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Cuban government, understanding how you do an epidemiological study, sent out people to interview 300 Cubans who lived in the neighborhoods next door, the workers in the hotel who would have entered those rooms that were supposedly under attack, and not a single Cuban showed any of the symptoms claimed by the U.S. The New York Times, to their credit, did some digging and found out, first of all, no such sonic weapon exists. Secondly, if it did, it would have to fit on the size of a truck and be parked out in front of the diplomats' homes. And third, such a sonic weapon, if it existed, could not have caused damage that was the U.S. claimed, particularly concussions. Sound waves don't cause your head to flap back and forth and give you a concussion. So the whole story, the whole theory just fell apart upon any kind of an actual investigation.
Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to be snarky about this, but...
Oh, go ahead.
In terms of examining the complaints of these Americans, how serious was that medical investigation? And did they rule out things like, related to overdoses of rum?
We have to take the U.S. word for it because they haven't made any of the medical reports available nor allowed any of the actual victims, the diplomats, to be interviewed by the press, which makes it suspicious. Usually when you have somebody who's been attacked by a foreign government, someone comes forward and talks about it, but none have. The whole idea of a sonic weapon has been quietly dropped. The U.S. no longer talks about it. Now they say, well, maybe it was some kind of virus or medically induced problem that was attacked. Again, they don't specify how. The whole version fell apart, and now they're kind of scrambling to try and come up with something else. And nobody's been interviewed, and no records have been provided.
And, Reese, because I'm a skeptic and because I've seen these patterns of behavior before, my first thought would be to look at the U.S. and its intelligence communities and the tools and toys that we have. And, if we come up empty in attempting to blame local causes, whether it's the Cubans or somebody else operating in Cuba, my second thought would be to say, well, have we deployed something in Cuba that has side effects that are affecting, for example, the people who have that dirt box or stingray in their hotel room or in the home where they happen to be living? Because we do appear to be the international leaders in various forms of electronic warfare. And so that would be my first hunch. And I'm just playing detective here. I'm not indicting the United States. I'm simply musing, looking for a probable cause.
I don't know the answer to that. Some 22 diplomats were affected, so I don't know that many would have been involved in some kind of surreptitious attacks like you describe. What we have is the U.S. version and the Cuban refutation of that. The Cubans hinted at the possibility of psychosomatic illness. In the U.S. we've heard about sick building syndrome and various other things. Basically, when some people get sick from something, the word spreads in a stressed situation that, oh my goodness, there's this sonic attack taking place. I lost my hearing. My eyesight's going. Things that you would otherwise attribute to something else gets attributed to the attack.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke with some doctors, and the Guardian newspaper spoke to some doctors who speculated that might be the case. But lacking further evidence, we really don't know.
And, Reese, the time period when this was alleged to have occurred makes it curious as well. It was during the transition from Obama to Trump, began in December of 16, and the reports seemed to taper off in February of 17. And at that time, Trump's intentions toward Cuba were not fully fleshed out. And since then, he basically rolled back a lot of the changes that the Obama administration had put in place. But at that point, Cuba would be thought to have had its best behavior in mind.
Yeah, it makes no sense at all from a political standpoint for Cuba to have launched an attack on U.S. diplomats right when a new administration is coming to power, right when they're trying to resolve and promote relations with the U.S. In December, of course, and early January, President Obama was still in power. And to start some kind of crazy attack on U.S. diplomats that they would know would undercut all their efforts just makes no sense. You know, the U.S. had recognized Cuba diplomatically. There was new economic openings. There were hundreds of thousands of Americans coming to Cuba all during that period. The only people that would benefit from this kind of disruption would be the ultra-right-wing Miami Cubans.
Yeah.
And the Cuban government kind of hinted at that, but didn't provide any actual evidence to indicate they had done something.
And how much damage do you think this did to Cuban-American relations, or given that Trump had intentions to pander to that Miami expat community, it was just a passing moment?
Well, it has an ongoing and very real impact on Cubans, because all the consular officials have left Cuba except for one who handles emergencies. So if you are an academic or a musician who's planning to visit the U.S., or if you are one of the 20,000 a year Cubans who get to legally immigrate to the United States, you have to go to Colombia or Mexico in order to get your visa processed. And that's thousands of extra dollars in travel expenses and hotels and that the Cubans don't have. So it was already expensive to begin with. The U.S. charges a high fee to process the visas, and now you have to go to another country to get it. So it's had a very immediate impact on Cubans. And I think as part of the Trump administration also announced rules that told people that had the effect of reducing U.S. People visiting Cuba. They said you have to come as part of a group, and you can't eat at certain can't stay at certain hotels, and you can't eat at certain restaurants, all supposedly to undercut the Castro regime and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And even though in reality people come to Cuba all the time and those rules are ignored, it did have an impact of reducing visits. So I was told roughly half the number of Americans are coming in this recent period as had come in a similar period the year before.
So you visited Cuba in January, Reese.
Yes.
Tell us if you picked up a different tone. And is there, also I'd like to know about the transition, because Raul Castro has extended his stay briefly as the supreme leader. I don't know exactly what title they use now. But talk a little bit about the mood you found and about the political developments.
Well, Raul Castro is both president of the country and head of the Communist Party. There's no supreme leader.
Okay.
That's Iran. We can talk about that one if you want. He announced that he would resign as president or retire as president and likely stay on as head of the Communist Party. And a new person would be elected by the National Assembly to become president. There's no popular elections.
Mm-hmm.
The mood in Cuba, when you talk to ordinary Cubans, it's not so much about politics, it's much more about economics. People want jobs, they want a decent living, they want the basics that everybody else wants. So you have an extensive safety net in Cuba. Everyone gets free education, everyone gets free health care. A lot of people still have government jobs. So you don't see the grinding poverty or, favelas like you see in Brazil or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the situation, and if you're involved in the tourism industry in some way, you're doing pretty well because you're probably at least getting tips, if not salaries, in hard currency. But for a lot of Cubans who are not in tourism, it's still pretty rough. It's every month you're kind of struggling to make sure you can make ends meet. The average pay is the equivalent of about $25 a month, and that's simply not enough for certainly a single person to survive well. And so when you talk to people, it's, what can I do? You know, people often pool their salaries because families, husbands and wives and kids and grandmas and grandpas all live in the same building. So you put all that together and you can survive. But it's still not anything what people are still discontent with that. And when you talk to people and you find people are angry or critical of the government, it's because of the economy.
Mm-hmm. And is there a designated successor to Raul Castro? You know, will this be a rubber stamp, or is it going to be, you know, a fairly open process with the National Assembly for the first time picking a leader whose name isn't Castro?
I wouldn't characterize it quite either way. It's not an open process. He will undoubtedly designate a person. There's some speculation as to who that will be. But whoever he designates will likely be elected. As I said, there's not popular elections. You elect someone to a local parliament who then elects someone to the national parliament who then picks the president. So it's all indirect.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And, Reese, I do want to get your comments on Syria, but before we leave Cuba, I can't resist asking. Over the weekend, I saw one of these posts on Facebook that, you know, is almost fake news, but then it produces enough circumstantial evidence to say, well, maybe there's something there. And it was written by Baxter Dimitri. I think it's Your Newswire, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, he put up a bunch of pictures of Justin Trudeau and Fidel Castro as a young man. And he reported that Margaret Trudeau, when her husband Pierre was the Prime Minister of Canada, visited Cuba. The allegation is that Fidel Castro is the father of Justin Trudeau.
And you heard it here, folks.
There's even a convenient picture where Margaret Trudeau returned with her baby to Cuba about 9 months after the official visit by her husband. So I just have to ask, have you ever seen anything about that? The other link to it is that one of Fidel's sons committed suicide recently.
Right.
And the allegation was that his suicide note included some nasty comment about how Justin got more attention than I did.
You don't do tabloid news, right?
I don't. I don't, but I saw that I said, wow.
That kind of reporting is way outside my field. I stick to reality.
Well, I understand.
I do not know if there's any evidence along those lines, and frankly, I don't care.
Yeah, all right. Well, I'll send you the link if I can find it, just sure. For grins. But I felt I needed to ask about that.
Okay.
Now, let's talk more seriously about the shooting gallery called Syria. Your most recent book, Inside Syria, was published a couple of years ago. And it really, many people thought that ISIS, the Islamic State, had been vanquished, the caliphate is over, and that this is returned to the dull and bloody civil war attempting to oust Bashar al-Assad. But we have Turkey getting active along its border with Syria in confrontations with the U.S. We have a U.S. airstrike on Syrian fighters, Syrian government, military installations recently. And just over this past weekend, there was a firefight that took out an Israeli F-16 that had gone in, they said, to take out an Iranian drone that had drifted into Israeli airspace. So there's a lot of conflict in a country that many people had said, oh, well, that one's almost over.
Well, I was not among them. I've been talking for a long time that it's actually going to become even more complicated if the Islamic State is defeated, and that's, in fact, what's happening. The Islamic State, and this is the little bit of good news, has been driven out of most of the areas that it called its caliphate. The actual physical territory that it controlled is now reduced to a sliver of land along the Syrian-Iraqi border. They still are quite dangerous in terms of terrorist attacks and bombings of civilians in Baghdad and other places. but they are not anywhere near as strong as they were before. They're on the ropes politically as well as militarily. But then that, of course, opens the question, who is going to take over the territory that they had once controlled?
Mm-hmm.
So President Assad and his forces, of course, want to do that. The U.S. wants to block that, and to date they're using the Syrian Kurdish group known as the YPG, or the People's Protection Unit,
right,
and the SDF, or the Syrian Democratic Forces. And what makes this particularly critical is that the Islamic State had controlled a strip of territory where Syria's oil production takes place. And on a world scale, Syria's oil production is not that great compared to Iran, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and so on. But for Syria, it's a very big deal because it's a source of hard currency. And so far, the U.S. has, with the SDF, has controlled that oil-rich area. So that clash you alluded to, where the U.S. actually sent in air and artillery strikes and missile strikes against pro-Assad military trying to take back some of that area, that was very, very significant.
Mm-hmm.
And then similarly, the Israeli Air Force in its attack, that's the first time an Israeli plane has been shot down since 1982, I think. And the Israelis countered with a brutal attack on both Iranian and Syrian facilities inside Syria. So what it's about is everybody is trying to scramble to take over the areas controlled by the Islamic State and deny it to someone else.
And what do you see as the current posture of the U.S. and some 2,000, 3,000 so-called advisors that remain on the ground there? And has President Trump's secret plan worked in ways that you didn't expect?
He has no secret plan and no secret sauce. He's announced that he's going to keep those 2,000-plus troops permanently in northern Syria. And that relies, of course, on a collective amnesia by the U.S. media and the Democratic Party. When Obama, I was there in 2014 when the Islamic State was attacking the Yazidis and they were fleeing from Iraq and so on. I was there witnessing it and reporting on it. And Obama said, this bombing we're going to start is just temporary. There's no troops on the ground. We're just going to stop the Islamic State and it's a humanitarian effort. And then, of course, he did send in troops on the ground. And then they sent in more troops. And then Trump came in and he sent in more troops. So now we've got 2,000. And from a supposed humanitarian effort, we're now in a permanent occupation effort. And those troops are fighting. Partly they're advising the SDF, this Syrian Democratic Forces, but they are also fighting. You know, when you direct your artillery fire, when you're flying airplanes, that's called fighting, where I come from. And it's another quagmire. The U.S., once you're involved there, when your soldiers are killed, which inevitably they will be, oh my God, we've got to do something. We've got to double down and send in more troops. And before you know it, you've got another Iraq or another Afghanistan.
And the other complication is with Turkey, nominally a U.S. ally, a fellow member of NATO, and Erdogan is openly antagonistic now toward the United States. He's made a tilt toward Moscow, and he is really a rogue operator, and his determination to wipe out Kurdish fighters, and it's a stretch, wouldn't you agree, to call the YPG, direct allies of the PKK, which Erdogan and the U.S. describe as a terrorist group?
Well, there's a lot of fancy rhetoric manipulation going on here. You're right. The president of Turkey, Erdogan, says that the group in Syria that I mentioned, the SDF, is a terrorist group because it's allied with a group in Turkey that's been fighting the Turkish government. First of all, the PKK is not a terrorist group. It engages in armed struggle. It kills and attacks police and military and government officials, but that's known as armed struggle. They don't engage in the kinds of massacres of civilians that Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State have done.
Well, and, so, and Reagan would call them freedom fighters.
Yeah, if you were exactly if you were in Afghanistan, you'd be a freedom fighter. But
right.
You know, during this time of the Soviet occupation. So, but setting that aside, basically, Turkey does not want to see the Syrian Kurds control a strip of territory that's contiguous and along the Turkish border, and they're willing to ally with anyone and oppose anyone in order to do that. So they've attacked the Syrian Kurds in the area called Afrin, which is on the far western part of northern Syria, where that strip of land that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And they are threatening to attack another city called Manjib, which is where U.S. troops are actually stationed. And the U.S. sent in tanks and armored personnel carriers with huge American flags and several high-ranking generals and someone from the New York Times to say, you know, if you attack Manjib, Mr. Erdogan, you're going to be confronted by American forces, or at least that's the implication. So that is a huge area of dispute. There are some in Washington and in the White House saying, forget the Kurds. Turkey's more important. We've got important treaties with them. We use their Incirlik air base that's critical for our air flights throughout the region. Forget about these Kurds. And others who are saying, no, we need the Kurds because if we're going to dismember Syria, we've got to have somebody on the ground to do it with. And these guys seem to be the best ones. And that's the real aim of the U.S. It has nothing to do with humanitarianism. It has nothing to do with protecting Syria against the Islamic State. It has to do with the U.S. will occupy a portion of Syria until Assad is out of power, and if need be, will dismember the country, as took place in Libya and in Yemen and Somalia.
Now, it's clear to me, Reese, that Erdogan is determined to prevent the formation of any form of a nation or a quasi-state that might be called Kurdistan. At the same time, the U.S. is really caught in it's a struggle with many dimensions. And number one, as you pointed out, we don't have any authority to put U.S. troops in Syria.
You're such a stickler, Peter.
Either from
you
our
want
own
some kind of legal justification.
Well, the Congress has not authorized it. They pay for it, but they don't authorize it, and they just shoveled more money at the Pentagon in this recent round of budgeting. And then we have, the complicated situation with Turkey. And the other element here is that the Kurds have attempted a very small-d democratic enterprise where women and men are equal. And women fight right alongside the men. And this is the Rojava, is that correct?
Rojava.
Rojava
that's
community.
That's the area that's their name for the northern Syrian Kurdish area.
Uh-huh. So talk about that a little bit, because there are just layers of irony here.
Yeah, the PYD, which is the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which is leading all these other groups that I mentioned, is a leftist party. They have adopted kind of a quasi-anarchist ideology that says men and women are equal, and they are very impressive in promoting women leadership and women fighting forces, which is unique in the region. There's not any rebel group or government, for that matter, with the kind of women's participation. They sponsor local councils that have guaranteed seats for various ethnic and religious minorities, for example, Sunnis and Shias and Druze and Yazidis. Syria is a huge country with many, many ethnic and religious minorities, usually some of whom got shut out by whoever else was in control of that particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And the PYD is trying to promote equality among the various people there. And something you don't hear about, they're usually talked about as wanting to control the Kurdish part of Syria. But their ideology is that this system can be applied to all of Syria, not just to the Kurdish region, and that's their goal. And I doubt that the U.S. is going to back them in that. And there's not an indication at this point that they have that kind of popular support. But what's interesting is the extent at which Sunni Arabs in Syria will participate with them in this government experiment in northern Syria and to what extent will it still be seen as just a Kurdish thing? That's something that's not yet figured out. But what makes it very strange, and there are Marxists participating in this efforts in northern Syria, this leftist group, quasi-anarchist group, has allied with the United States, which has got its own motivations. And the U.S. wants to dismember Syria. The other folks, the rebels, want to control Syria, the entire country, through democratic means. Those two goals are not are incompatible.
Mm-hmm.
So either the U.S. is going to convert the rebels to being pro-U.S. proxies, or the leftist forces are going to give up the chance of getting support from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
In the medium realm, for sure, those two goals are not compatible. And
yeah.
I talked about that in my latest article.
And would you speculate that you expect the United States to end up putting more assets into Syria without any authorization?
Oh, that, I think, is inevitable. It started off with 500 troops, but they were not boots on the ground, right? They were just advisors, and they were just talking to the Syrian Kurds, and it worked its way up to 2,000. It's probably higher. They always lie about the number of troops.
Yes.
But they have official ways of doing that, so maybe it's 3,000 troops, and there's, you know, they're going to be in clashes with this, with everybody, with the Turks, with the Iranians, with the Syrian government, and you need more troops to be able to fight that, to protect the troops you've already got there. It's this never-ending argument of, oh, my God, our troops are in harm's way. We have to send more troops to protect them. I think it's going to be more troops sent in, yes.
Let me ask you about what I consider to be still an open controversy over the claims that it was the Syrian military that used sarin in Khan Shukun, Syria, last April. And, you know, the consensus view is that they did, and the International Chemical Weapons Group did their investigation and claimed that Syria was responsible. The United States immediately blamed Syria, and Trump responded with his missile launch from Mar-a-Lago when he was entertaining the Japanese prime minister. But as you look at this almost a year later, what is your take, Reese?
Well, I think there's no question that both some of the right-wing rebels, that is Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, have used chemical weapons, and I think the Syrian government has used chemical weapons as well, particularly chlorine.
Mm-hmm.
Chlorine gas is relatively easy to make. There have been some verified incidents with outside observers where, you know, Syrian helicopters and these barrel bombs that they use were laced with chlorine to make them even worse in their impact.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the Khan Shukun incident that you mentioned, I'm still an agnostic on that one. It was a huge attack. It was against an area that was being under attack by the Syrian government. And unlike some of the other ones, there were actual international chemical, as you mentioned, observers who tracked down through blood tests and so on that there was sarin used and how and where it was used. So it's a more convincing case than some of the previous ones. But there's still holes in it, and I'm not convinced completely. I think this is one of those issues that when the war is over and there's a thorough investigation, we're going to find out more about it.
Well, Reese, I'm in a similar position. I remain skeptical of the official response by the U.S. government. And the late Bob Perry dug up a little nugget from the end notes or the footnotes of the OPCW report. And it showed that there were many people who'd already reported to hospitals claiming symptoms of exposure to sarin before the flight that was alleged to have dropped the sarin weapon on Khan Shukun actually occurred. And this is like a 3 to 4 hour gap. The other circumstantial evidence is that the first responders didn't seem to be taking any basic precautions from being exposed to the individuals who we did see on video who were foaming at the mouth or otherwise reacting to something very toxic.
Right. Well, this I don't know about the end note. I would actually love to take a look at that if you want to forward it to me.
Okay.
As for the first responders in the rebel areas of Syria are just ordinary people. They don't have hazmat suits or access to other protective gear, and so I would not be surprised if they simply showed up in civilian clothes. And presumably, at least initially, you don't know what's happening. You don't know what the source of it is. You don't know what your personal danger is. You're going to pull people out of buildings. So that argument is not too convincing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And while I agree with you, the U.S. has not made this flaws in how the U.S. describes what happened. There's also big flaws in how the Syrian government and the Russians describe what happened.
I agree.
What happened? They claim there was a bombing of a warehouse that was full of other kinds of weapons, and that's what caused the sarin-like symptoms. But there was no such other warehouse or secondary explosion or anything like that. So I don't think the Syrians have ever adequately refuted what had happened either. So that's why I remain skeptical about both sides at the moment.
And while we're in skeptical zone, let me ask you about the alleged attempted coup in Turkey in July of 2015, because it has been used as the basis or pretext, depending on your view, for a massive crackdown. You know, teachers and anyone who had any remote connection to Fethullah Gulen have been purged. And at the same time, Erdogan has become almost a dictator for life by revising the system there. And so I'm curious about your take on that.
Well, I think there was a coup. There was an attempted coup. It was led by some military and police officers. Whether it was connected to the Gulen or not, that's an open question. You may recall that troops took over the bridge that connects the European and Asian part of Istanbul. There were people who were killed in the streets. There were efforts to seize various key installations and that sort of thing, military bases. It failed. The military remained loyal to Erdogan. He got on, I think it was Facebook or some social media, and broadcast that he was okay.
I recall.
There was an attempted coup. People were killed, and Erdogan emerged victorious. And, of course, what he then did was to use the excuse of the coup for a tremendous crackdown on all of his enemies, including Turkish Kurds, the established parties, the leftist party that had actually gained quite a bit of popular support in the previous parliamentary elections. And then he arrested people, tortured people, and generally tried to crush all opposition from the left and the right. He seems to have, he renewed fighting against the Kurds in the eastern part of Turkey. He's, for the moment, a popular guy. He manipulated the people's opposition to the coup and also their nationalist sentiments. And it's very dangerous because he's just taken over more and more power for himself and less democratic norms.
And while we can raise honest questions about Obama's commitment to human rights and his backing for dictators ranging from al-Sisi to Erdogan, it's very clear that except when Mike Pence wants to demonize Kim Jong-un, that there is no human rights basis to foreign policy today, and that dictators are just fine.
Absolutely. And the more pro-U.S., the better. You left out the dictators in Saudi Arabia and virtually every other country of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. criticizes Iran for lack of human rights, and there is a lack of human rights in Iran. But it pales to comparison to the lack of human rights in Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or many of the other pro-U.S. dictatorships in the region.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Reese, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up here?
Well, my book, In the Iran Agenda, is going to be updated and reissued in September.
Great.
And I would love for your listeners to check that out. And I'm my homepage is reese-erlich.com.
And also, I found your recent reports at 48hills.org.
Yes.
That's
yeah,
Tim.
I now have a syndicated column. It comes out locally in the San Francisco area at 48hills.com. It's mm-hmm. in the Progressive and various other media nationwide. So it comes out every 2 weeks.
All right. Well, we'll keep following you, Reese, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with journalist Reese Erlich. Send me your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.